China floods Africa with foreign aid.
And Washington takes stock of the worst drought in decades. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. It is Thursday, July 19th. We're also going to talk about the first fine ever issued by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and it hits Capital One, the credit card company. Also talk a little about the prospects for Nokia, whose earnings came out today.
Also, the interest rate rigging scandal with the big banks gets bigger, and we'll ask if there's anything that could be done to rein in these behemoth banks. It's all coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
We'll start with the worst drought since the 1950s, which is taking a toll on the Midwest. Corn and soybean prices are at record levels.
That's already hurting farmers, and it could impact all of us soon in the form of higher prices for everything from cereal to chicken. We're joined this morning by the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack. He's with us from Washington. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, who is being most affected right now by this drought, and where are you focusing the government's attention?
Well, the interesting thing about this drought is how widespread it is. If you take a look and compare this drought to what occurred in the 1930s and what occurred in the 1950s and what most recently, about 25 years ago, occurred in 1988. This drought is less severe at this point in time, but certainly more widespread.
And what kind of impact could it have? What are your fears about that at the moment?
It's already having a very significant and serious impact on production and yields. We expect at this point in time about nearly 40% of our corn crop and a little over 30% of our bean crop is in poor or very poor condition, which are very high numbers. Conversely, those numbers are somewhat similar to how much corn is in good and excellent shape. And normally we have 60 to 70% of our crops in good to excellent shape. And now we're looking at 30% of our crop.
Any sense yet about what that's going to do to consumer prices?
Well, here's the interesting thing. The livestock producers are the ones who are most impacted directly today by this drought. So they may start liquidating herds. When they do that, prices for meat and poultry and pork over time, they'll go up a bit. But it takes quite a bit of a jump for food prices to be dramatically affected by something like this.
Mr. Secretary, I want to ask you one more question before I let you go. This is, as you said, the worst drought in decades. The first half of this year, according to the government, was the hottest in 118 years of record keeping across the country. The UK has just had its wettest June since records began there. Is it the view of the U.S. government that this is climate change?
Well, I'm not an expert on climate change, and so it probably wouldn't be appropriate for me to respond specifically to that question. My focus, and I think the focus of the USDA and the president right now, is on making sure we get help to these folks. That's our focus. It's not trying to figure out today what may be causing this or what may be impacting it. We know it is impacting farmers and ranchers. Our heart goes out to their families and these hardworking folks. We just want to be able to provide them some help and assistance.
Tom Vilsack is the Secretary of Agriculture. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You know, Jeremy, that Alec Baldwin, he just can't catch a break.
What's in your wallet? I was going to say that.
So he's a spokesman for Capital One, of course, and Capital One is paying $210 million to settle charges it tricked credit card companies into buying expensive add-on services. There is no fine for Alec Baldwin specifically, we should say. It is the first fine, by the way, that the Obama administration's Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has issued. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
The agency's first enforcement action signals the CFPB intends to take an aggressive approach to banking industry abuses, so says Consumers Union senior attorney Norma Garcia. She notes Capital One is being held responsible for the actions of a third-party vendor that ran the bank's call center.
What we were finding in the past is that as the buck was being passed, nobody was being held responsible, and that's got to stop, and it looks like that's what's happening.
Garcia says the agency also took a no-nonsense approach to refunding consumers by ordering an automatic credit to their account,
which makes things a lot easier than to have to pursue getting your money back.
The CFPB might have started out punishing a big name, but critics say the irony is the new agency actually gives bigger banks an unfair edge. Sam Kasman speaks for the Free Market Competitive Enterprise Institute. He says big banks can afford this new layer of regulation.
small banks around the country have folded up certain lines of business simply because they can't carry the regulatory burden. And what that means is they're giving up business to large banks.
Kasman vows his group will keep trying to block the CFPB in court. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
More banking news now. It appears more of the world's largest banks are getting roped into allegations of fraud. According to this morning's Financial Times newspaper, four big European banks have joined Barclays in the not-so-prestigious club of financial institutions being investigated for rigging interest rates.
The widening scandal comes on the heels, of course, of that monster J.P. Morgan trade gone bad, which has cost the bank billions of dollars. So what can be done to keep these problems from happening? Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell joins us now to discuss. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, Chris, it's just scandal after scandal from these big Wall Street banks. What can be done about this?
Well, I think we need to break them up. I really do. And there's a simple way to break up the big banks, and that is to dust off the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act. It's a very, short piece of legislation, and it's, most of us are pretty familiar with it. We're comfortable with the notion that, we're going to separate this investment banking and this trading from institutions that take deposits from you and me. It worked for about 60 years.
Well, what about the argument, though, that some would make that if we break up our banks, there are still going to be these behemoth banks in the Netherlands and Switzerland and the UK that will be doing investment banking and consumer banking and will just be at a disadvantage?
I don't see the problem, because that was true for most of the post-World War II era. I mean, the universal banks of Switzerland and of Germany and, the U.S. grew to be the largest economy in the world. But we had a banking system that largely supported Main Street rather than Main Street having to support or do what happens to the financial system.
Well, did we miss our opportunity to do big banking reform like this? I mean, we've already passed the Dodd-Frank financial reform law, Chris. That was a hard thing to get through Congress. It's very complicated. Didn't we miss our chance to do another big redo of Wall Street banks?
Jerry, I'm not laughing at you, but I'm just sort of thinking, okay, now look, we went through the whole Lehman Brothers collapse. Now we've got the J.P. Morgan and its trading losses. Now we have the LIBOR scandal. I mean, here's the thing. The banking industry is going to give us plenty of opportunity to embrace reform again. And what I would urge is let's make the change now before the next big scandal.
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell, thanks as always.
Thanks a lot.
Well, at the United Nations today, the Security Council is expected to vote on economic sanctions against Syria. The UN is trying to bring an end to the 16-month conflict between the government of Bashar al-Assad and rebel forces. But will more economic sanctions work? Here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
The UN resolution threatens top Syrian officials with asset freezes and travel restrictions unless they come and talk peaceful transition. Washington imposed similar sanctions yesterday. And the intended effect is walls closing in. Ian Willis at the corporate intelligence firm Alico traces Middle East money flows.
It's about limiting the options, limiting the room for maneuver for the regime so that they find it much more difficult to envisage a future life of wealth and luxury.
For the inner circle, the point is to go after people's treasure and question their loyalty to the Assad regime. Here's Nadeem Shahadi of the London think tank Chatham House.
It would influence people's decisions on whether to stick around and support the regime or maybe defect.
What sanctions may not do is shut down Syria's broader economy. Despite a European oil embargo, Damascus still has friendly trading partners. Paul Salem is with the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut.
They have not choked off the Syrian economy or the Syrian regime. They have not been utterly decisive in that sense.
He sees sanctions as a slow-motion squeeze in a fast-moving conflict. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
China held a forum today with African leaders, and China offered $20 billion in loans to countries throughout the continent over the next 3 years. That essentially doubles China's previous aid to Africa, and it strengthens a relationship that has attracted a lot of criticism from the West. Marketplace China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz is with us now from Shanghai. Hello, Rob.
Hi, Jeff.
First, a little background. China's been putting money into Africa for quite a while now, right?
Yeah. I mean, 10 years ago, African exports to China were worth $5 billion. Today, they're worth $93 billion. and U.S. exports to China are at $104 billion. So the Africa-China relationship is a really big one.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people compare it to the early relationship between the U.S. and the Middle East, which was, of course, based on oil. But what China's getting out of this relationship is a wider range of resources. You've got oil, copper, uranium, you name it. Africa's really got it all. If China wants to continue on this incredible economic growth trajectory that it's been on, it really has to have these resources. Today, Chinese President Hu Jintao reminded African leaders of the importance of this relationship for both sides.
The creation of this forum fulfills the demands of the times. It reflects the wishes of the Chinese and the African people who are seeking world peace, development, and cooperation.
So, world peace, he says, not that we can't take him at his word, but doesn't China get a lot of flack for working closely with countries that have kind of rotten records on human rights?
They do. And the U.S., of course, has a history of doing this, too. But China's received, you know, really a firestorm of bad press for its cozy relationship with, among others, the government in Sudan, whose president is wanted by the International Criminal Court for genocide and crimes against humanity. So those who are concerned with China's continued investment in Africa point to its financial support for a long list of corrupt leaders. And that's support that's helping these leaders stay in power.
When China gives foreign aid to Africa, do they do it in a different way or with different intentions than, say, a Western country like the U.S.?
Yeah, it is a little different, and there's been a lot of debate about this. Of course, much of the aid that the U.S. sends to Africa comes in the form of poverty alleviation and, you know, things like feeding starving children. China tends to focus instead on building bridges and buildings and roads, basically copying its own development formula from the past few decades and pasting it onto Africa. And there's been a lot of debate about which type of assistance works better for Africans.
Marketplace's Rob Schmitz from Shanghai. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jeff.
Be careful what you agree to, Jeff. Town of Mittenwald in eastern Germany lent Berlin 400 guilders, whatever those are, back in 1562, way back in the year 1562. The money was supposed to be repaid with 6% interest a year, but it never was. And somebody smart, kept the receipt, which was just found in an archive. And according to Radio Berlin Brandenburg, the debt now adds up to $136 million, but when you adjust for compound interest and inflation, it's actually in the trillions. Now, it doesn't look like Berlin is going to pay, but if it does, I'm thinking the European debt crisis just got way bigger.
Where do they get a contemporary guilder to euro exchange rate? That's what I want to know. What's a guilder worth these days? Anyway, while we've been going international for a while here, let's go really international. Scientists at NASA have been trying to replicate what space smells like. Apparently, it smells like something. Astronauts know, Jeremy, when they come back from spacewalks, that their suits and all of their gear and everything smells like something they describe as steak, hot metal, and like arc welding smoke, if you've ever smelled that. That doesn't sound like a great... That sounds nasty.
That's weird, isn't it? Yeah.
So they've asked a chemist here on Earth to recreate that just for fun, I guess, or maybe for museums. People can smell space. And apparently smells – well, I say apparently, duh. Smells are basically based on molecules, right? Whatever molecules are floating around, they'll create the smell. So scientists can look at very far away places and use their telescopes and whatever scopes they have to tell what molecules are there and divine what they smell like. So there's a dust cloud called Sagittarius II way off in the middle of the Milky Way. And evidently, that smells much better than the rest of space. It should smell like raspberries and rum should we ever get there.
Hmm. Maybe that's why they call it the Milky Way, because it smells like a chocolate bar.
Just dip some raspberries in it. Yummy.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
So a short while ago, we talked about Alec Baldwin, of course, his endorsement of Capital One looking a little sketchy at the moment. Well, he's one of those celebrities that has had kind of an on-again, off-again relationship with Twitter. At the moment, it seems like there's kind of a trend. From Alec Baldwin to John Mayer, more and more big-name celebrities are choosing to drop out of the Twitterverse.
Here to talk with us about what this means in today's Midday Extra is Devendra Hardawar, who is national editor of Venture Beat. Hi there.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Going well. So why do you think all these celebrities are leaving Twitter in droves?
I'm not sure if it's in droves, as a lot of these reports tend to be, but I'm not surprised to see celebrities that maybe as they amass millions of followers and they really, you know, start using Twitter to its full potential, which is a direct connection to fans. At that point, you know, a lot of these folks who are used to having handlers and who are used to having people in between what they're saying and their fans, that direct connection can be kind of scary. And if you make any mistake, you know, it can come back to bite you really quickly. So, yeah, I can see if something bad happens, they may just want to give up on this whole Twitter thing.
So you basically have these celebrities deciding that it's just too risky to be real, I guess you could say, that they'd rather be kind of managed and have everything edited and made sure that it's all okay before they put it out there with their fans.
Yeah, I think like maybe from their managers or maybe from their own perspective, they realize that there is a certain value to having the mystique of being a celebrity. And when you're directly in touch with people and people are seeing how you actually speak or how you're actually thinking without any handling, that can be kind of scary, and it kind of may, I don't know, it may remove some of the value you have as a celebrity too.
Let's talk about the value to Twitter and what they gain from having these tremendous forces for good or ill, I guess, depending on what they're posting on the site.
Yeah, so for Twitter, I think, and we're seeing this for a lot of web services too, celebrities, be it Justin Bieber or anyone really, like when they join a service, a lot of their fans and a lot of mainstream users tend to follow. So for Twitter, having these people on early, they were great to help Twitter get some mainstream acceptance. And now that they're leaving, though, I don't think it's actually going to hurt the service too much, especially since these celebrities tend to come back. And I think a lot of users, once they start using Twitter, they can see the value of it, too. You're always seeing more and more celebrities come on. And kind of when controversies happen, that's kind of, it's kind of fascinating. It's like you're watching or reading a supermarket tabloid in real time.
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting, if you take the celebrities out of this equation, you just think about the idea of how tied into social media we are these days and trying to give it up altogether. And oftentimes they end up coming back, don't they? They can't stay away for too long.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's something addictive to it, and it kind of speaks to the power of Twitter. You know, unlike Facebook, unlike a lot of other web services, Twitter is all about communication. So this can go multiple ways, but I think from a lot of the celebrities or a lot of people that I know who kind of have big followings I've chatted with on Twitter, they kind of appreciate that direct connection with fans. But there is a balance. So if you go overboard, if you say something dumb, it can come back to bite you.
Devendra, there was a study a little while back. I don't know if you saw this, but I think it surprised a lot of people because it showed that a huge number of the followers on Twitter belong to a very small number of people. That is to say that Twitter had become, in a large sense, just this sort of a PR machine, admittedly maybe a dangerous one, for celebrities and other people who had managed to acquire a lot of followers. So if Twitter starts to lose celebrities, is there any sense that maybe it kind of goes back to its roots, you know, more of a grassroots kind of a communication mechanism?
I'm not quite sure that'll happen, just because it's not just celebrities making Twitter useful, too. It's other notable figures. Like, I don't think Barack Obama is a big celebrity, but his Twitter account, which is managed by, you know, his staff, but occasionally he makes a tweet on his own. People find value in the things, in the really important Twitter accounts that are out there, and also just following their friends and using it for that, you know, for that reason. I still think Twitter they still have a lot to figure out in terms of how they can really reach those mainstream users who may not want to follow any of these celebrities or who don't want to use the service as it is right now. But I don't think losing these celebrities will kill Twitter in any way.
Devendra, are you on Twitter?
I am, yes. I am at Devendra on Twitter.
Very good. Well, Devendra Hardawar at Venture Beat, thank you so much for talking with us. And Jeff and I are also on Twitter, by the way. Jeff, what's your handle?
Very complicated. It's at Jeff Horwich. So if you can spell my last name, you're most of the way there.
I'm at Jeremy Hobson. And of course, the most important, at Marketplace APM, is the show's Twitter handle. So follow all of us. And Devendra, thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, there's a new study in the journal Lancet that says lack of exercise now causes as many deaths around the world as smoking. And according to the latest figures, obesity costs Americans about $200 billion a year in medical expenses. So perhaps it makes sense that for the first time, Americans polled by Gallup see obesity as a bigger problem than smoking or alcohol consumption.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said...
Frank Newport is editor-in-chief at Gallup, and he joins us for our weekly segment, Attitude Check. Good morning, Frank.
Hey, good morning.
So, Frank, we're more concerned now with obesity than alcohol or smoking.
That's right. And when you say we're more concerned, we're talking about how serious a problem Americans perceive it to be out there. It's not like, are you concerned personally? But we said, how serious a problem do you think those three things are? Obesity, cigarettes, and alcohol. We have asked the question a couple of times previously, about 8 years ago. And back then, it was obesity and cigarettes tied for the most serious problem of those three. Alcohol was below it. Now, we have had an increase in concern about obesity. 81% of Americans say that obesity is a extremely or very serious problem, and that's now well above the 67% who say that about smoking. Drinking, by the way, is down at 47%. So all of this concern that we hear in the news media about obesity is percolating its way into the minds of Americans, it looks like.
And do people want the government to get involved in fighting obesity in a bigger way?
That's a great question. Not nearly as many people think that it's important that the government get involved in fighting obesity as say it is a serious problem. It's 57% of Americans who say the government should be involved, and that's compared to 81% who say it's a serious problem. You ask why? It's Republicans. Republicans are very much against the government doing anything about obesity, whereas Democrats are very, very high. There's a huge gulf there. So what we're seeing here is a lot of pushback from conservatives that the government should be doing something about it, even though they recognize that it's a serious problem.
And I hear you've got some numbers about what exactly Americans who drink alcohol like to drink.
Yes, actually, we've been asking going back all the way to 1939, believe it or not, tail end of the Depression, do you drink alcoholic beverages at all? Right now, 66% say they do. That means 34% of us are total abstainers or teetotalers. We took that 66% and said, all right, what's your beverage of choice? Beer, wine, or liquor? And it is beer, but not by much. 39% of drinkers say beer is their favorite beverage, 35% wine, and 22% liquor.
What's your choice, Frank?
Well, I rarely drink, actually, although the medical data show, you know, the occasional drink would be good for health.
Good glass of red wine or
but
something.
When I do, it would be a glass of wine. That's right.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at Gallup. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Nokia was, until this year, the world's biggest maker of cell phones. And today it turned in a $1.5 billion quarterly loss, triple what it lost at the same time last year. Nokia also just slashed the price of its new headline handset, the Lumia 900. The company has an awful lot riding on that little blue hunk of metal. Nokia has major fans and plenty of detractors as well. And here we've got one of them. We'll find out which she is. Annette Zimmermann is a principal analyst with Gartner Research. And she's with me from Munich. Hello.
Yeah, very good to be here. Thank you.
What's the biggest news to you out of Nokia's earnings announcement today?
Well, I think it was probably not so surprising to see these results, given what we heard earlier from the company. And one part that was good to see was that the volumes of Lumia devices have picked up. So that was encouraging.
Nokia's operating system for its new phones is based off of the new version of Windows, or it will be. How much will Nokia's future success depend on whether people like Windows 8?
Well, I think Nokia has actually a lot to offer as far as differentiation. So they have certain types of services that other vendors do not have. For example, I'm talking here about location-based services. This is something that users will definitely look at, and it's very good value for money.
But of course, if people don't like the new Windows operating system, they're not going to want a Nokia phone.
That's right. But there were very, very positive results on the usability of Lumia devices. And I think the other thing that Nokia also has is very good design. If you look at the phones, the Lumia 800 or 900, they're great pieces of work. So this is definitely a capability that Nokia can excel on.
It sounds to me like you are considerably more sanguine about Nokia's prospects than most of the sort of gloom and doom coverage that we see. What are other people not seeing that you are?
So I definitely see the caution here with the company at the moment, definitely, as everyone else. But in general, I think there are some good things about Nokia, definitely, that this company has and that other companies actually right now in the market that are also struggling don't have.
Well, you might wind up looking like the wise sage here when all said and done. We'll see. Annette Zimmermann is a principal analyst for consumer markets and technology with Gartner Research. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we've been talking about phones and tablets here, Jeremy, and one quick item as we wrap up here. Samsung and Apple, you've probably heard about this. I'm sure you've probably mentioned it many times, are engaged in this big legal battle in various places
battles,
on Earth.
Right?
Yeah, patent battle over the iPad and maybe some other things. But in this case, it's the iPad that matters. Well, Apple just lost a round in Britain. Apple's claiming that Samsung stole its iPad ideas for its own tablets. And the judge ruled that Samsung did not copy the iPad in designs for its own tablets. And here's the penalty from this creative judge. Apple has to put language in its website and put an ad in British newspapers saying that Samsung did not copy it. So they have to actually just go out and broadcast to the world.
That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, but the best part of all, maybe, is the reason that Samsung won this lawsuit. The judge ruled that Samsung did not illegally copy Apple's designs because Samsung products were, and this is a quote from the legal opinion, not as cool.
Poor Samsung.
If they had copied them, they would have been cool.
Wow.
And they weren't cool. I love it.
Well, finally, to another advertising campaign for Cumberland Farms that put 570 cardboard cutouts of the former Baywatch star David Hasselhoff outside convenience stores around the country. Well, it appears some of his most devoted fans have been hassling the Hoff. All but 20 of those cardboard cutouts were stolen. Cumberland Farm says if you have one, Jeff, they just want to know that the Hasselhoff is safe.
Have they looked in Germany? They were all taken away and exported to Germany.
Right.
Well, in Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.